Conversation with Dr. Stuart Nelson of Howard University, March 3rd, tape one.
Mouth on the record now. We're in business.
You might be interested to know the genesis of this trip to Africa.
I should be interested to know, yes.
There was a conference here in Washington last year, developed by AMSAC in New York. And that has to do with the African cultural interest. And they brought 12 or 15 leading Africans from Central Africa, East and Central Africa. It was at a time, of course, and all times now are like this, when they were greatly agitated over South Africa and the Portuguese possessions. Some of these men were brilliant. They had written, and they spoke. There were about 3 days of the conference. And I met one Sithole. I was chairman of one of their panels, and Sithole was on my panel. Now, Sithole is a political leader in southern Rhodesia, and he was in exile then in Darjeeling. And, not Darjeeling, I mean in Tanganyika, Dar es Salaam. He spoke one evening at a dinner and at other times, and was almost bitter. He was trained in theology in this country, so there was something in common between us. His view was nonviolence is all right, provided the person against whom you use it has a conscience. When he doesn't have a conscience, you may have to resort to violence. Well, you see, immediately that gave us a point of departure for discussion. Well, he heard me express my own views briefly, and he said, let's have a talk.
Now, may I interrupt a second? Yes. Just to check your voice here. See,
yes. See, my voice, is that sufficiently loud?
That's fine, yes. That's pretty good.
Yes.
Fine.
Well, this might interest you. So we sat down and talked, and he was interested. Having this theological, this religious background in common, he could see something of what, he could understand what I was talking about. So he said, why don't you come to Dar es Salaam and talk with us there? I think they'd like to hear you. Well, I put it aside. Then all of a sudden, I got the idea, I believe I'll try to get a grant from the university. We have a research fund here, and people are getting grants for travel and writing. So I asked for a grant for a 7 or 8 weeks trip to Africa. And I went, beginning at Ethiopia and going down. Now, the purpose of this was to interview as many of the thoughtful people in Africa as I could meet with, to see what they thought they had to resort to, or could best resort to, in order to overcome the situation as it's developing in South Africa and the Portuguese possessions. You see, some months before, there had been this meeting of the heads of states.
Yes.
In Ethiopia. And they were greatly agitated there, and they were talking about building an army and doing this sort of thing, resorting to boycotts. I was trying to see whether there was any feeling whatsoever that they might use nonviolence, satyagraha, in facing their problem. Well, I got the grant, and I went. When I arrived in Nairobi, I read in the papers that Sithole, this person with whom I talked here, had gone back to southern Rhodesia, had been arrested. And I said, ah, that's the end of Sithole and me getting together. But fortunately, I went to southern Rhodesia as the guest of the Consul General there, Paul Guerin, who is a very longtime friend of mine. And Paul said, when we talked on the telephone, I was in northern Rhodesia and he was in southern Rhodesia in Salisbury. He said, be sure to be here Sunday night because I'm having a dinner and there's some people I want you to meet. Sunday night, Sithole was present. He had got out of jail and he was on bail. Well, Paul is interested in this whole thing himself. And he said, I'm going to call on you tonight to make a talk. I'll call on several, but I'd like for you to talk and talk about this thing that's so much on your mind. So I did. Miss Satoli was sitting right across there. And we talked around. Well, we stayed until midnight. And quite a discussion. Now, after I returned home, I heard from a friend of mine, Dr. Pitt Van Dusen, who is the now retiring president of Union Theological Seminary.
Yes, yes.
Brilliant, brilliant man. I happened to run upon him in Salisbury. I talked with him. No, I heard from a second party, that Pitt had returned and said that Satoli had now gone over completely to nonviolence, that he was working with Kaunda, who, of course, is the leader in nonviolence now, I would say, among the African statesmen. And he was developing groups, cadre, of nonviolence. Well, I don't know that my going had anything to do with it whatsoever, but you can never tell. When a man has a background that lends itself to this kind of an interpretation, when you confront him squarely with all the views, one against the other, and a man who swiftly grasps, you can never tell. So that interested me very much.
Sure,
that
sure.
Interested me very much. I don't know what has happened, and I'd like to follow that up. Well, as I said, I talked with Nkrumah and Nyerere and Kaunda, and then cabinet members and lesser people all over Africa, and learned a very great deal. Learned a very great deal. I was 6 hours in Johannesburg, saw the township there, was taken around by a friend who showed me everything that there was to be seen in that short time. Now, I don't have enough on which to write anything. I don't know enough about Africa. I can write about India because I've spent nearly 2 years of my
yes.
life there, and I've been studying India for 15 to 17 years. I'm reading a great deal on Africa. I'm trying to learn everything I can. And in whatever I write later, I hope to weave into it my impressions, the impressions I got in Africa.
On the question of violence, may I read you a little passage from Dr. Kenneth Clark
yes.
on the subject of Dr. King.
Yes.
When you, as you may have encountered already. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while black nationalists betray pathology and instability. A deep analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reactions to injustice, oppression, humiliation, bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the spirit seems inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and intolerable burden upon them. That passage is I found of interest. How do you respond to it?
I would take a position diametrically opposed to it. I would say that the most enduring, the greatest moral insight or insights, not to put it in religious terms, but to put it in moral terms, they are usually expressed by religious leaders and are given religious coloration. But I'll put it in moral terms to make it a little more modern. I think the deepest moral insights that we've had from the beginning of moral and religious literature urge upon us the very thing that Martin Luther King is doing. I think it's testimony to a belief that in man there is something better than you find in the brute. It doesn't say that a part of man's nature may not and does not find expression in the opposite to this.
In other words, may I interrupt a second?
Yes.
By Dr. Clark's rendering, you are dealing with this other part where the aggression and resentment is short-circuited and you get effects on the personality that are bad. But you are saying, just to be sure I understand you, I'll say it back, but there's another aspect of man's nature which can be actually developed by this discipline. Is that it?
I'm saying that inherent in man
is
the possibility of rising above the brute that is also in him. We are both men and animals. You and I can engage in a brawl and in a fight if we want to and if we permit ourselves to, if our histories have been different from what they were. At the same time, we can embrace each other and sacrifice for each other, give our lives for each other, appeal to what we believe is deep in each other, in the hope that however the one may have offended the other will somehow understand and forgive, and hope that that offense will never be repeated. I'm saying there is that in us, as well as the brute in us.
That you don't believe in the man without a potential conscience exists, except in the case of pathological cases, that is?
I would act on the assumption that it doesn't exist. No man knows what is in man, absolutely. But I'm willing to commit my life to the assumption that in every man who is not subject to pathology, who is not crazy, in every man, there is the possibility of having him reveal by what you do toward him this finer self, affection, love.
In Mississippi, I encountered every stripe of opinion, of course, on this matter.
Yes, indeed.
Here's a place of crisis.
Yes.
And where physical violence is always a possibility.
Yes.
Every day it's a possibility.
Yes.
At the riot in Jackson, at Jackson College a few weeks ago, in the street there, there was a great chance of a real blow-up. It was headed off, partially at least, through the efforts of Mr. Evers, who went among the students and got them back, tried to quiet them, get them off the street. I didn't see this, it's all report to me.
Yes.
Now, some of the younger people I talked to deplored this effort to break the, to get the crowd off the street. They said that, all right, we can have a crisis, we need one, and violence, and then maybe the guard, then nationalized guard, and then we have the showdown. This would be awfully unpleasant, but some Machiavellian tactics were the only thing that will break the deadlock. From that extreme position on up to the position you have outlined,
yes.
All sorts of scaling down this line
went
up against a point of real physical violence.
Yes.
The assumption there is no conscience in the Jackson cop, you know.
Yes.
But here's something now. Puzzled me a great deal. Mr. Evers, in his conversation, had said bloodshed solved nothing. Birmingham was a disaster, is his phrase, and things of that sort, you see.
Yes.
That the line of nonviolence. 5 days later, on the 17th of February, in Nashville, he made a speech advocating non-selective reprisals. Saying, reporter, write this down. If a church is bombed with children, we shall bomb a church with children. If a Negro is shot, we will shoot a white man. Not selective, it's just a white man, children, these are the words, these are the years.
This is very puzzling to see this man change his whole view in 5 days.
Yes.
And I've written asking if he can somehow clarify what happened in his mind during that period. I haven't yet heard from him. But it's a very strange fact, this sudden shift, some deep emotional shift during 5 days.
Mr. Warren, that isn't at all strange with me. These men who are plunged into this are not plunged into it on the basis of long thinking and profound conviction. They are gathered up in a movement which, up to this point, has succeeded pretty well. They sense that there is something good in it, but immediately that it doesn't work, they are skeptical about it, about its workability. And they turn to what society has always turned to, for the most part, and that is reprisal. I'm not surprised at all. The wonder is that more of them don't do that in the beginning.
That's the wonder.
That's the wonder. That's the miracle.
Mrs. Richardson had a comment on this episode. By the way, I wanted to report that I had real admiration, you see, for Mr. Edwards. This is...
Yes.
I'm not, you know...
Oh, I understand.
I thought fine.
I understand perfectly.
About rapport, I thought at least. Anyway, Mrs. Richardson said, no, this was a mistake. She said, to get them back on the camps and leave them. She said, you have to go in. She said, go in, talk with them, get the violence out of the kids who are about ready to go wild, pray, sing, and say, now we're going right back on a nonviolent basis.
Yes.
So that the people would not think they were afraid. They would not, and also they would not be bottled up and feel frustrated.
Yes.
So go back, and this time, we're going an hour later or 2 hours, we'll march out again, this time with nonviolence as the program. She said, we should let it cool off for weeks and days. Something happens inside.
Yes.
It festers.
Yes.
This is her analysis of that situation.
Yes. Yes. I think something like that is right. The person has to be brought along by stages. The fact of it is, after it's all over, in another context, he might act the brute. There's no guarantee that he is an absolute convert to nonviolence when this is over, as is shown in other instances
sure.
in the world.
Sure.
But out of the group, you're going to get some converts. And you're very likely, in many persons, to get a modification of his view toward life and how to get things done in life. Because he will see some minor miracles himself, you know, as this thing progresses.
Dr. Clark goes on. I may have the quotation here. Yeah, another. It's not here. That many white people admire Dr. King because he lulls them into the fond hope that the Negro will not resent, that this is a way of perpetuating the notion of the Uncle Tom equaling Negro among whites.
Yes.
And this is accounts in part at least for the admiration that many white people feel for Dr. King. How much sense does that make to you?
I wouldn't be surprised, but that many white people would choose him as against someone who was always on the edge of force and using violent language. On the contrary, I would say that a far greater, and comparisons are always dangerous, but I would say that a far greater number of the American people who have responded favorably to Dr. King have responded because they see something deep and profound and good and workable in what he's done. After all, we are, a majority of our people are professed religious people, have some religious background. You can't get totally away from it. And whenever there is a great sacrifice on the part of any individual in the country, and that comes to the notice of the American people, they rise to it. They see something in it which transcends their own abilities to perform. They see something of the best. Now, I think they have recognized in King something that appeals to them as reflecting this thing they've been taught through religion all of their lives, wish they could do, but can't.
Dr. Clark also says, or strongly implies, that this movement, which has worked in the South, you see, he admits, to some extent, would not work in the North. I presume because the religious background of the Negro in the North is less immediate than it is in the South. That there's a religious basis in the South that is not in the North, and the appeal to nonviolence on his terms would be therefore weaker in the North.
I believe myself, under the same circumstances, with the same irritations in the North as you have in the South, which you do not have.
Yes.
The North is not the South. But if you started with the same situation, it would be more difficult in the North, because you have a different Negro in the North, particularly. But even so, it isn't because it's more difficult. It's whether, number one, it's possible, and number two, which is more important, is it the right thing to do? I mean, is it a response to what really is the right thing to do? And the right thing doesn't always win immediately. We go centuries. We go millennia before we see the right course of action coming into fruitage. And it seems to me that that is important. If we are going to act on the as intelligent people and as people of moral idealism, if we are going to act on the basis as to whether this act is going to work immediately in this particular context, and if it doesn't, we're going to use some other, then it seems to me we are turning away from the profoundest the truth that we have been given in the history of mankind. And that is that there are ideals which it will require millennia to realize in our everyday life.
There's so many things you have started there, I hesitate to take just one, but I'm going to take one that's implied in how we started this topic a moment ago. In relation to this comparison of North and South, how do you account for the fact that suddenly, in a matter of just a few years, the leadership of the Negro movement has been largely Southern?
Number one, the problem is predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly Southern. Number two, Martin Luther King happened to be in the South. Just happened to be. He could have been in Rahway, New Jersey, or anywhere in Harlem, but he happened to be in the South. The problem arose in the South. He was present there. It was simply a coming together of events, and which evoked a certain response, and there you had it. You can't explain historically why these things happen. Probably it couldn't have happened precisely that way in the North. It could have. But you would never get the same complex of events and persons that you did there. As I think of it, it was extraordinary. Now, here, he was a man trained in the North, primarily. Of course, he was trained South and North. He had his parents, his grandparents, great-grandparents.
He went to college in Atlanta.
He went to Morehouse.
Morehouse.
But then he read his philosophy and read his religion in the North. He heard about Gandhi in Philadelphia. And he brought all of this, you see, to bear upon that moment when his house was bombed. I mean, you can't repeat that. You can't say Could it have happened in the North? It's difficult to say, to get that concatenation of events.
But he is one among many of these leaders. I mean, there are dozens and dozens. Now, I've getting survey and autograph to article on this subject. This question arises, and start calling the names, this massive percentage of the new leadership, which is from the South.
Yes.
There are various interpretations of this.
Well, I can understand that. First, the problem has been concentrated there.
Yes.
So you call upon the leadership that's there. And we have a very large Negro religious leadership there. I would say in the second place, there is more religious, a greater church membership among Negroes in the South than you get in the North. The North is somewhat different from the South from the standpoint of the church, for example. You can get a far bigger crowd and more big crowds at a church on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock in a big southern city than you would get in the northern city. And most of those who are going to church in the northern cities are people who come from the South, and they're older people. You see, they're older people who continue in the North, in the large churches in New York, in Harlem. So you have there, you do have a greater mass of people. Then, I mean, I'm just thinking now, there is less of a certain kind of sophistication among the mass of these religious people in the South than you have in the North. When you get to Harlem and stay there for a while, or when you get to Chicago, there develops a certain kind of sophistication. You have a different life. And you're not quite as amenable to the religious message as you are in this totally, almost totally segregated life in the South. There is greater simplicity of life. So you do have, you're likely to have a greater response to the kind of message the King and his and the other leaders give there than you would in the North, without any question. I have preached in Harlem, and I have preached in the South, and I know the responses of the audiences. I go to Cincinnati and Chicago, and you have something of the same, but not the same, audiences that you have in North and South. And so you are likely to get a greater response in the South than you get to this message. Let us say to the simple gospel message.
Yes.
To the
yes.
simple gospel message.
I was talking with Ralph Ellison about this point. Ralph is born in Oklahoma, but educated in the South, in Alabama.
Yes.
Tuskegee, and knows the South very well. His line of thought ran something like this. It's parallel to the notion that you hear sometime of the benefit, the marginal psychological benefit of segregation in annealing a character, toughening character, which in some of the surveys has been a frequent response made by leaders, Southern leaders, or Southern-born leaders. And it's said by Mr. Farmer, among others. So he said this segregation toughened me. It did not make me doubt my abilities. It gave me the will to use them. And Ralph takes the view that part of this, of it, one element in the development of Southern leadership was what you were saying, I guess, in other terms, was the pressure of the immediate segregation itself. It toughened a body of leaders, given the will to resist, to deal with it. Where the more vague humiliations and more vague repressions of the North tended to bleed off. The issue was not joined, clearly. And actually, the segregation had proved a kind of breeding ground in the last generation for our leadership.
Yes. I would say that it is true that in the North, the issue is not joined as completely as it is in the South. The joining of the issue, I mean the almost totally repressive aspects of segregation in the South, has two consequences. One is to rob the Negro of the power to resist, either externally or internally. You may have heard the story of the Negroes who were singing outside of a tobacco factory, a song that went like this, "Been down so long that down don't bother me. And one of my unhappy experiences in living in the South," oh, I was born in Kentucky.
Yes, I know you were.
But I lived in New Orleans and I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina. Spent 9 years in the South. My great disappointment was to discover the extent to which the people did not respond in, were not agitated by the what they had to suffer. They took it and lived with it.
Do you think, then, that one of the problems has been the fact that the Negro accepted the white evaluation of the Negro in some deep way?
Often.
Often.
Often. You hear, if you moved about Negro society, you would find Negroes often making expressions which betrayed the fact that they themselves saw the effects, at least felt the effects, and was expressing and were expressing an opinion of those effects, of the effects of repression upon the Negro himself. Yes.
I don't know how to far I could generalize about this, but in my conversations I begin to see a pattern something of this sort. A mother or a father, so far, most often a father in the background, whether the father may have been, say, poor and illiterate or semi-literate, would say to the son, "Look, don't believe what they say about you. Believe in yourself. Don't believe what they say about you." Some image of it that the father could give the boy.
Yes.
That would toughen him.
Yes.
To self-respect and to refuse the white man stereotype.
Yes.
Of the Negro. I don't know how far to push this, but this is certainly the tale told by more than with one person I've talked.
Yes.
To. There's a man in the background, sometimes a mother, but usually it's a father who.
Yes.
Says this.
I would say two things. First, though, I don't know whether it's the mother or the father. I wouldn't know. I don't know. But I would say this, that there's always in the Negro the potentiality of expressing resentment. But it has to be evoked often. If there is no minister, if there is no teacher, if there is no father, if there's no mother to evoke this, then he falls under the same problem of accepting. After all, there is only so much of trouble that a man can bear before he yields, gives in. You just, of yourself, can lift yourself out of a situation in which you have been found, been thrown for generations. You tend to yield to it. There comes along, however, a prophet, or there comes along a friend, or there comes along a parent, and says, "Move out of this."
who gives the person a new sense of identity, a new sense of his role. Is that the...
Yes. By identifying him with something other than that to which he has become identified.
The white man's view of him.
Right. He's a laborer. He's called boy. He's never been called by his last name by a white man in his life, nor the woman. Well, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years of that. Now, it takes an operation, a major operation, to alter that person's view of himself once he has been subjected all of these years to the other man's view of himself. Now, when a Martin Luther King or a Shuttlesworth or someone else comes along, or a parent, if it's in relation to a child, and says, look here, look here, and gives, take the minister, in the case of the minister, gives him something great to look forward to. God made you a man. Jesus Christ died for you. And that says something. Or with a child, with a young man, you have the same education, you have the same possibility. Look at so-and-so who has succeeded. You can do the same thing. Get out of this. But when he doesn't have that kind of evocation, then he becomes enslaved to the forces that are pressing him down all the time.
And the resentment may bleed away into random violence or criminality or psychic disorder. The resentment gets short-circuited. It's not constructive in that case. Is that it?
There is always in the individual the brute. I'm saying the brute in...
Yes, I understand.
I mean the kind of... that's in all of us. When you get mad and swear, or when you get mad and slap, or when you get mad and shoot, that's in all of us. If there is no appeal to the other side, this side is going to take over because it's profound in us and strong and is there every minute of the hour and every hour of the day. So if there's nothing to evoke the finer, then this is going to take over. It's built into our emotional life, physical life.
A psychiatrist I have a slight acquaintance with, who is a Negro, made the remark to me that the new movement is a shift from matriarchal society among Negroes to a patriarchal society among Negroes. But the father has returned, as he put it. I don't know how he would argue this. There's some plausibility superficially to it anyway, I should think.
Of course, you know that in the South, the mother has been the stirring figure, and I would say has done more than the father to lift the child out of the depression in which he has been pushed by the circumstances under which he has lived. It's the mother, not the father. I would say it isn't, a psychiatrist would know infinitely more about this than I would, but it isn't sex. It is a strength that might at one time reside in the mother and one time in the father. But I think in the South, it is the mother who has held this society together and who's held the race together.
And this goes back into the slave situation where the father might be sold off, or the mother sold off with the child, so the continuity was necessarily with the mother then.
Yes.
And after the same thing persisting into the next period.
Child knew no father.
Often
knew no father. You take Frederick Douglass, you take
yes.
Booker T. Washington.
Yes.
As classic instances of that. And the mother was there.
I'm certain you have read Faulkner's Sound and the Fury.
You have the figure of, remember the figure of Dilsey in there? That figure of this Negro woman who is the repository of both toughness and human charity for black and white all around her is now sometimes being attacked as simply the white man's fantasy. Folks who wants to feel about it, what a nice mammy Dilsey was, rather than seeing her as a figure of moral force and this moral center of the whole book. This swing is now taking place.
Yes.
Some
yes.
Negroes attack Dilsey, so this is just Aunt Jemima sort of figure.
Yes.
That kind of
yes.
tone about it. Do you have any reaction to that situation in Faulkner's book? Or have you read it recently enough?
I have not.
Impression?
No, I'm not. My recollection is not clear. But on the problem itself, my impression, and this is just an impression, because I haven't studied the problem deeply, my impression is that the Negro woman has yielded to her situation often because there was no escape, but that deep down always, more than the man, now, this is speculation, more than the man, she has harbored a reserve of strength which she's passed on to the child, and which in climactic circumstances she herself has expressed. I think it's true today. The woman in Montgomery who walked the streets until her feet were tired, you know?
Yes.
But said there was a feeling in the soul. This woman has been the mammy and she's been repressed, but she's kept something deep within her, which in the dead of night she's often passed on to the child. When the man was carefree, moving about, gone off. You see, the mother has the child with her, and you always rise to your highest when you have a responsibility. When you have a human being for whom you are responsible, who is right there, it seems to me draws out of you the best. Now, the man who leaves the child behind and goes off, and he isn't in a context of life which I think on the whole would draw out of him the best. So my tendency would be to give greater weight to character in the Negro woman than in the Negro man. Now that is, as I say, highly speculative.
Sure, it has to be. We can't prove those things in themselves, can we? Let me switch the topic a little bit. Let me read you a quotation. This is from Rose, you know, Arnold Rose.
Yes.
Myrdal's collaborator.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's on Negro history, the teaching of Negro history and the Negro history movement. The whole tendency of the Negro history movement, not as history, but as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape reality. The actual achievements and the actual failures of the present. All the movement consciously tends to build race pride. It may also cause Negroes unconsciously to recognize that group pride is built partly on delusion and therefore in the end may result in a devaluation of themselves for being forced to resort to some self-deception. Now, we can't assess it, I'm sure, statistically. Mm-hmm. But it's a question of whether there's a germ of truth in this apprehension.
There is, I think, grounds for a division of view there. When you try to develop group consciousness, you are in one sense placed on the defensive. In the second sense, you are arguing for what profoundly you don't believe in, perhaps, or perhaps what you shouldn't believe in, and that is a wider brotherhood. The deeper insight is that we are not different, basically, and we don't want to act as if we are different, basically. Why have a Negro community? The fact of it is, there is no Negro community, in a sense. I guess the great majority of Negroes are so mixed that they are not a pure race. They have every element, almost, racial element that's developed from the beginning of...
What is the figure? 75% at least of the American, at least of the American, in quotes, Negroes, only a small, have something else anyway.
Yes. Yes. Profoundly speaking, he may argue, if he studied and if he thought this matter over, he may argue, what we want to do is to break down the stereotype. And to argue that I'm a part of humanity. In me, there is the English, and there is the Irish, and there is the all of it. And what I want to do is to make myself known among men and the world as a part of this rest of the world. Now, that is one possible view, and some may feel that that is the profounder view. On the other hand, you are thrown into a social context. Your life is so cast that you are, call it Negro or call it colored or call it anything you want, you are apart from the larger society. You live in the neighborhood with people of the same color or people of the same history, general history. You go to the schools that bear the same color or the same caste. You go to the church and you're surrounded, for the most part, by these same people. Your life as a whole, your language, the literature you read in a large measure, the speeches you hear, are often around this same text. And therefore, you are somewhat aside. And in order to break this bond, you have to unite and call yourself whatever you want to call yourself, a Negro community or a black community, but unite.
And find the Negro history of Negro achievement.
Well, you need to unite around that which gives you an incentive to break this bond, whatever that is. And, of course, one of the things would be certainly that you have power, you have ability. Look at your history. Look what you have a history. Look what you've accomplished. Look what you accomplished in Africa. Look what you've accomplished through your American history, coming out of slavery. And you have accomplished this in spite of all the difficulties.
I suppose one part of the significance of that
is that the attacks by the hate literature, such as the thunderbolt I saw yesterday from the National States Rights Party,
yes,
devoted largely to attacking the notion that the Negro had a history.
Yes.
The fact that this group didn't feel it's necessary to attack that fact or to
yes.
attack who are Negro heroes in one article in this thing I read
yes.
yesterday.
Yes.
Saying they aren't any, you see.
Well,
this is the other side of the coin. It's the pressure to affirm this. Now, Rose's point, I suppose, ultimately directed at some sort of race chauvinism that may come out of this.
Yes.
Did I take it anyway?
Yes. Which is a danger. Any kind of chauvinism is bad, is a danger. But then every minority group that's oppressed is faced with this dilemma and faced with this disability.
The Southerners have been faced with it. They have created, they have lived in a history
yes.
since 1865,
yes.
which has been partly they fulfill the need for identity and for achievement.
Yes.
And the myth of the Old South, insofar as that is a myth, and it's a big myth, piece of myth there, all right, or fulfills the same need for the Southerner, that in this way, that Negro History Week forms for the Negro.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. He, I think, has done himself a profound disservice in trying to break the bonds by increasing the bonds.
The white Southerner now.
The white Southerner, yes.
Yes.
By identifying himself as a Southerner, when what he should have been doing is trying to break the bonds and becoming an American and a citizen of the world, becoming emancipated.
Let's pursue that a moment. This speculation. We say that the Negro has suffered from a loss of a sense of identity. He's had to accept the white man's version of himself
yes.
and has not been able to affirm his identity as a man and as a Negro man. These two things in one
yes.
package. So his liability has been the loss of a cultural continuity, the loss of identity. Take the ordinary white Southerner now, confronted by the situation as of this moment or earlier. Is it possible that part of his resistance to change is based on a fear of a loss of cultural identity? Loss of his identity as, quote, Southerner. That in a mistaken way he has tied the segregation to this whole notion of identity, of his identity, in a symbolic way rather than a literal way. He feels he must defend segregation in order to be himself, mm-hmm. in some, to defend his culture, to defend his identity in a culture. But if you could distinguish these elements for any rational man, he would say, what was I thinking about there? The deep need for identity, the deep need for cultural continuity, is somehow staked on segregation for many Southerners.
Yes. That is very sad.
Does this make sense to you?
Yes. I think it's true, and I think it's one of the saddest bits of truth in American history, that a great and potentially a great part of our country has lost its opportunity through its past to break away from its weakness, because it has felt that really, without knowing it, that weakness was a source of strength. That is, becoming united around an evaluation of itself which was not a complimentary evaluation of itself. May I?
Please do.
But let us debate whether that isn't better than remaining in your fortress and trying to preserve your culture.
I suppose you are answering before I ask the question. I was going to read passages from Dr. Du Bois on the question of the split in the Negro psyche on this very matter.
Yes.
I'm sure you know his arguments,
well,
so I won't read the passage.
Yes.
But for the record here, the division on this basis, the pull toward identity as Negro, the pull toward the African mystique, even,
yes,
the pull toward a cultural continuity to be elaborated and lived in as Negro. This over against the pull to enter Western European American culture, to enter that society and perhaps be lost in that society with the personal heritage and the racial heritage, cultural and biological lost in the end, absorbed, gone. What sense of this split, or as he puts it, in the soul?
Yes.
That, I gather, doesn't make much, isn't a question for you, I guess, what you say, or am I misinterpreting what you said?
If I were forced at this moment to express a view on this, I would say something like this. I would want to defend everything of good that I could possibly find in my past. I think every man has a right to do that. He has a right to search and search and search for everything good that he can find in his past. I mean in his group past.
Yes, I understand.
Not that he's trying to build up an ego.
I understand.
But in his group past. And I'm on the search for it. In Africa, I'm looking for it. In the South, I'm looking for it. In my parents, I'm looking for it. Having discovered it and made use of it in increasing my own feeling of possibility, personal, or in the feeling of my most intimate friends, their possibilities, I'm willing to say this is for any group to use that wants it, any other man to use, any other society to use.
You mean it's part of the human story,
it
then?
It becomes a part of mankind. I'm no longer concerned simply in keeping it to myself or within my group. It belongs to mankind. And I'm willing to share it in any way I'm called upon to share it. I think that is the way that that society ought to work.
For some Negroes and for some whites, the problem is really acute, though. For some Southern whites, it's acute.
Yes.
How do they keep their identity and remain, be Southerners without repudiating something of value,
yes,
impiously repudiating something?
Yes.
How can they still act then freely?
Yes.
Or be American or take other values in their local prejudices? I'm going to change this tape. This is the end of tape one of a conversation with Dr. Nelson, see tape two.